From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
Every 2 years, the California High Speed Rail Authority is required to submit an updated business plan. What are the biggest challenges confronting the high-speed rail project, and does the newest business plan make the changes necessary to make the vision a reality? We'll ask Tom Van Heek with the California Legislative Analyst Office, John Kapal with the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, and Tom Richards, the Vice Chair of the High-Speed Rail Authority Board.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. As well as support from Era Energy LLC, Bonner Family Foundation, Community Medical Centers, Harris Ranch Inn and Restaurant, Nossaman LLC, Sagasser Watkins and Whelan, and Valley Children's Hospital. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. High-speed rail was first endorsed by the voters in 2008. What is the project's current status, and what is the plan going forward? Our guest is Tom Van Heek, an expert in the high-speed rail project with the nonpartisan California Legislative Analyst Office. Welcome to the Matty Report.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
So, Tom, can you give us a quick overview of the high-speed rail project?
Certainly. The high-speed rail project proposes to construct a high-speed rail system connecting San Francisco to Anaheim via the Central Valley. And Los Angeles, trains in that system would run in excess of 200 miles per hour. To design and build this, the legislature established the High-Speed Rail Authority. That's a state entity in 1996. Mm-hmm. And then in 2008, the voters of the state approved Proposition 1A. That approved $10 billion in bond funding, to partially fund construction of the project.
Yeah, it was interesting when I was reading some of the stuff that you've written. It talks about electric trains capable of operating.
Right.
Capable. Not necessarily they're going to go 200 miles an hour, but they have to be capable of doing that. So.
Right.
The project is divided into two phases. Can you briefly explain the two phases?
Sure. So phase one of the project is what we were just talking about, connecting San Francisco to Anaheim. That's about 500 miles.
And can we call it L.A.?
Sure.
Close enough.
Phase two, which is sort of more conceptual at this stage, would extend the system to Sacramento in the north and to San Diego in the south. Previously, the authority estimated completing phase one in 2029 at a cost of about $64 billion. And there are no estimates right now for the cost or timeline on phase two.
Okay, so phase two is just really conceptual at this point.
That's right.
Sounds like. So let's talk about the delivery plan for at least phase one. Let's focus on that. That's the San Francisco to LA, for lack of a, I know I'm short-circuiting here a little bit, but LA to San Francisco portion. So how is phase one going to be built out and at what cost?
Yeah, the authority is planning to build phase one in segments and portions, starting with the connection between the Bay Area and the Central Valley. The first full high-speed rail services would operate on that line, and you'll often hear that referred to as the initial operating segment,
or IOS. And so it's kind of the valley-to-valley segment.
That's right.
But it's not high-speed rail all the way into San Francisco. I mean, it's they've got Caltrain, right?
So there's a Caltrain corridor there.
Blended system, they call it.
They propose to share the tracks with Caltrain between about San Jose and into San Francisco. Some of those services would probably not be running at a full high-speed
I don't see how they're going to go 200
miles.
You're not going to be zooming up the peninsula at 200 miles an hour.
There are safety concerns around that. So the trains from San Jose into San Francisco would likely run at slower speeds, sharing the tracks with Caltrain. But you get a one-seat ride from San Francisco down into the Central Valley on a high-speed rail train.
So you've got this phase one. Let's call it the LA to San Francisco. What is it going to cost to build out that segment? Again?
Phase one's total construction cost is currently estimated at $77 billion. That's an increase over the previous estimate, and that came out of a new business plan that was released this year.
Okay, so pretty expensive. $77 billion probably got people. This is, remember, 2008, this was a $10 billion bond measure.
That's right.
By the way, did they assume that was going to pay for the total cost?
No, the bonds were always proposed as a partial funding mechanism. Okay. And then the idea was that hopefully about a third of the funds would come from the federal government, about a third from the private sector, and about a third from the state. As it's turned out, that hasn't quite played out in reality.
Yeah, and I think if you look at this historically on major infrastructure projects around the country, typically the federal government does step in. That third wasn't unreasonable to assume because you see like 50% sometimes.
Sometimes as much as 80% on some rail projects.
Right, yeah. So it wasn't unreasonable at the time, but politics, things change, and it's nowhere near that. So where is the money coming from then to pay for high-speed rail?
Yeah, well, so far the authority has identified three main funding sources. The first is that $10 billion we talked about. That's the bond funding approved by the voters. The second's about...
Well, let's talk about this for just a second before we run, because I know you've got others, but I want to get through this in a little more detail.
Sure.
So of that $10 billion, has that all been spent?
No. Actually, only a small share share of it's been spent so far, maybe $2-3 billion to this point. Okay. So there's quite a bit left in the bank, as it were, to tap into. Okay.
Can that money be used for anything else?
So a share of the bond money is actually allocated for what are called connectivity projects. These are improvements to transit lines that would feed into the high-speed rail system.
Caltrain, maybe?
Caltrain, for example. They're a funding partner on the electrification of the Caltrain corridor mm-hmm. in the peninsula. Otherwise, improvements to BART, for example, or LA Metro, okay. that would feed into the high-speed rail line, which is conceived of as sort of a spine to a larger rail network in the state.
Okay, and then you got federal funds.
About $3.5 billion in federal funds that came through the stimulus package in 2009. And then there's an ongoing stream of funds from the cap and trade program, valued at about $750 million a year on the high end. And the cap and trade program, of course, is the state's emissions reductions program. Right. And selling permits to polluters generates funds, and those right. revenues are allocated accordingly by the legislature throughout the state.
And they designate 25% of those
about
funds.
About a quarter of those funds are coming to the authority each and every year until 2030.
Okay. We're going to talk a little more about some of the bigger challenges outlined in the latest business plan in a moment. This is the Maddy Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddy Institute. We're talking with Tom Van Hecke with the nonpartisan California Legislative Analyst Office about the major features of the most recent business plan for the high-speed rail project. So regarding the most recent business plan, how has it changed in terms of the scope of this thing called the initial operating segment, which is valley to valley?
That's right.
So the Silicon Valley to the Central Valley. How has that changed?
Yeah, the authority released its latest business plan in the spring of 2018, which it's required to do in every even-numbered year, and it introduced a couple of important project developments, including this scope change to the initial operating segment. So previously, the segment was to connect San Jose to Shafter, which is a community just...
Shafter, I don't think people...
Just north of Bakersfield.
It's kind of the argument yeah. you hear from politicians that train to nowhere. No disrespect to Shafter, but people are saying train to nowhere.
Yeah, there was a proposal for a temporary station in this small town. Well, now the authority wants to extend this line into San Francisco and into Bakersfield proper, so connecting
which makes sense.
Larger population centers. Right.
Right, right. And it's going to take a little longer, isn't it?
It is about 4 years longer now. They're assuming a launch of operations in 2020. It
doesn't take 4 years to get you from Shafter to Bakersfield, but there's other things,
exactly.
complications in the project.
That's
I mean,
right.
there's things, buying parcels has been a big issue.
And, utility relocation has been
and they didn't,
a challenge.
They were surprised by that in Fresno,
mm-hmm.
And that cost them some things.
That's right.
Another change was a call for interim services. What are they talking about there?
Yeah, in an effort to begin delivering mobility benefits to the state as soon as possible, the authority is now proposing to launch these early interim services on completed portions of this route as early as 2027. So this could include separate services, one in the Central Valley and one on the peninsula in the Bay Area.
So you're going to have, in a sense, you're going to have these two one going like from Gilroy to San Jose, mm-hmm. another one going from, I guess, what, Madera to Bakersfield or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, that's right.
They're not going to be connected.
They won't be connected
at that
point.
But they may be used by Correct. Amtrak or something?
Yeah, that's right. So there are currently services that operate in these areas. So Amtrak, San Joaquin service in the Central Valley, the Caltrain commuter service in the Bay Area. And they're proposing that those could be enhanced to use these new pieces of infrastructure.
Because now they're sharing, Amtrak shares it with the freight lines.
The freight lines, that's
so,
right.
So, I mean, great if you're going from Bakersfield going to Sacramento. I mean, the first half of the trip or whatever is going to be pretty fast.
Yep.
If you're in Fresno, you're only going 20 miles to Madera, and mm-hmm. not much of a difference.
Right. Those are some of the consequences potentially of that.
Yeah, but having the train go from Gilroy to San Jose, I think that would be kind of significant because of housing issues.
Yeah, it's possible that this would allow for electrified and enhanced Caltrain commuter service on that corridor, and that could be beneficial to ease some of the housing challenges in
yeah,
the Bay Area.
I think they see it as potential benefit. I mean, if That's you ever right. drive those roads going to the Bay Area, and there's some people taking super long commutes,
mm-hmm. yes.
either in from Gilroy or up from, you know, like Madera, Merced into the yeah. Bay Area, you know, they're getting up at 4 in the morning.
That's right. So there could be some early benefits there.
Yeah. So the project's construction costs, those have also been revised. How?
Yes, the costs have been revised upward.
Not really surprised. Okay.
The total cost to complete construction from San Francisco down to Greater Los Angeles is now estimated at $77 billion, which we okay. talked about earlier. That's about $13 billion higher than the previous official estimate of $64. And there are several reasons for that increase, mm-hmm. One of which is they're now building greater contingency estimates into their projections.
More of an ish.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Right. There's been some cost escalation due to these schedule delays that we're seeing, so there's inflation in the industry.
Right.
And then there are just greater costs for completing the construction that's already underway in the Central Valley.
Yeah, it's not surprising. So the funding plan, that's also changed a little bit. How has that changed?
Well, as you know, Mark, this project hasn't had a complete funding plan since its inception. It's always been in a very constrained funding environment. Mm-hmm. The authority has tried to address that in its recent business plan, and it's sketched out a funding plan that better meets its articulated needs, but it does rely on a couple of really important assumptions. The first is that the cap and trade program that we talked about earlier is extended to 2050, and then the authority...
Right now it ends at 2030.
Correct.
Yeah.
And then the authority would securitize the additional revenues from that extension. So that...
Getting a loan on
exactly.
In the income. You have a job, you have a certain amount of money coming in, yeah. So you get a loan and...
They'd bring those future revenues forward in sort of a lump sum
to make
some major procurements and then pay it off over time, somewhat like a loan, as you said. It's possible that would be sufficient to complete construction to Bakersfield from San Francisco, but probably not much further. And then the second assumption is that there would be additional funding available to complete that balance of construction from Bakersfield into
LA.
But the authority is not very clear on where that money might come from. It suggests maybe federal funds, maybe securitizing net operating revenues from the early services, but those are big question marks.
Yeah, they're not getting any dollar amounts. Okay, so... What are some of the issues you think still need to be considered?
Well, the foremost issue for consideration is the fact that at this time the authority does not have a complete and viable funding plan for the completion of the project. They've secured about $13 billion in funding so far. They have that $750 million a year from cap and trade going forward to 2030, but that's simply not enough to get even the first segment of the first phase done. So the authorities propose securitizing cap and trade revenues, maybe net operating revenues in the future, but there's great uncertainty about the viability of those approaches. And it's not even clear that in the most optimistic scenarios, enough money would be generated from those approaches to actually complete the work. And that raises another important issue, which is that costs could still escalate further. The range that the authority proposes runs as high as $98 billion for completion of phase one. So ultimately, the success of this project does rely on a sort of a reliable funding commitment, and the authority just doesn't have that right now.
Okay. I want to thank Tom Van Hecke from the LAO's office. Up next, what do the critics say? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. High-speed rail is not without its skeptics. One of them is our guest, John Kapal with the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. Welcome back to the Maddie Report.
Pleasure to be here, Mike.
So what do you think about the most recent business plan? Do you think it's more realistic in terms of cost estimates?
No. I think all the business plans that have been produced up to this point should be in the fiction section of the bookstore. Until we have a comprehensive audit and that audit is completed, I don't think we'll have a grasp as to what the business plan can be or should be. We opposed, as you well know, we opposed the high-speed rail project from the very beginning. In fact, even before it passed by the voters, which it barely passed in the year that Obama was elected president, we commissioned with the Reason Foundation a due diligence study, and it was co-authored by a former vice president of Amtrak, a big pro-rail guy. Every transportation expert who has looked at this said, high-speed rail may be good for Asia, may be good for Europe, can't work in California, and that's where we are right now. The federal money isn't there. The private money isn't there. The fare box revenue projections are off the chart, and the costs, of course,
Let me ask you this. I mean, some people say that the critics are negating the fact, or at least minimizing, kind of the environmental and economic benefits. So air quality, the money coming in for economic opportunities for Central Valley, housing opportunities for people that live in Silicon Valley. Shouldn't they be part of any cost-benefit analysis?
Absolutely. And let's talk about the greenhouse gas emissions. Remember, this project is being held on life support by the cap and trade revenue. But even LAO says that the project itself will be a net producer of greenhouse gas for the foreseeable future. And think about it. If the ridership isn't what they projected, and of course we argue and have shown that it's way off, then what you've got is a project that's producing greenhouse gases, not reducing them. So that doesn't, nothing is more productive of greenhouse gas emissions than having traffic stopped on a freeway. That's where we should be spending that money, into lane capacity and roads.
Now, I'm going to get to that in a second. So let me ask you that. Get into that. So projections are that California's population is going to increase about 10 million people in the next 40 years. That's the size of the state of Ohio. That's a lot of people. There is a limit to how many more lanes of highway lane miles we can add.
Sure.
Or even adding to our airports. There's a limit in terms of capacity, what we can do there. Shouldn't a comprehensive transportation system include a viable statewide passenger rail system?
Yes, and it should be a conventional rail system. We would be all in support of expanding Amtrak to Los Angeles.
You don't want to take that bus from Bakersfield to Los Angeles?
We don't want to take that. And look, I've taken the bus from... Taking the bus from Sacramento to Stockton to pick up the train to Bakersfield. Mm-hmm. I like it better when you have the full train ride.
Right.
not a bad experience. I've taken the Capitol Corridor down to the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. These are legitimate systems that, and we fully recognize that they will not be self-sustaining, that there's some degree of subsidy that has to happen. But the subsidy projections in order to fully implement high-speed rail, look, the farebox revenue won't cover 1% of operating costs.
So if your transportation dollars are limited, we know that, right?
Right.
So what are the factors that should be considered when determining how to spend those dollars?
Well, a lot. Number one, efficiency, cost effectiveness. Whether or not the transportation agencies and systems we have now are being well run. Legislative analyst says that Caltrans is overstaffed.
They did kind of back off that. They did say $500 million in expenditures, and they kind of backed off that recently.
Yeah, they did back off, but it's still in the hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, California fails to contract out much of the work that it could relative to other states. That's just one example. Regulatory red tape as it involves environmental projects. There's a lot that can be done. Caltrans in the 50s and 60s was the best transportation agency recognized worldwide. Unfortunately, Governor Brown version 1.0, when he brought in Adriana Gianturco, really destroyed that agency, and it's never recovered from that.
Let me ask you this one last question. So what do you say to those who say, you know, California used to think big, aqueducts, UC, the CSU system. Have we lost that capacity to think big?
No, I think there's nothing wrong with thinking big as long as you think big with planning. And when you think big without planning, what you have is the high-speed rail project.
Well, that's a good way to sum up. Thank you very much, John. Up next, what do the supporters of high-speed rail think? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking about the most recent business plan for high-speed rail. We're now joined by Tom Richards, the Vice Chair of High-Speed Rail Authority Board. Welcome to the Maddie Report.
Thank you.
So critics say that your cost estimates are still a little unrealistic and that in any event, how in the heck can you project out into the future? So how can the public trust your numbers?
Well, first of all, we're pretty satisfied with our cost estimates today in the 2018 business plan. They're certainly far more developed than they were 8 or 9 years ago when we started this, in my case, on the board. Everything that we are developing today is based upon better experience and now being under construction for 3 years. So that what I would say to you is that the numbers that we had before back then was without a lot of experience. We've got that experience. Our numbers have moved from 68.4 in 2012 to 77.1. We're not happy with that, but that's because we were better able to define the uncertainties that we didn't know in 2012.
Right. I don't know if any project, private or public, that always comes in exactly what you assume when you first start the project, right?
We would have liked to have been the first, but that wasn't
right.
In the cards.
Okay. So. Good try. So critics also allege that the revenue projections are a bit uncertain. They're saying that, for example, that the business plan assumes that the cap and trade program is going to be extended from 2030, the current deadline, to 2050, mm-hmm. and that high-speed rail is going to be able to leverage that money to get loans. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think it's been misunderstood. The intent of putting that in there was what would happen if cap and trade got extended to 2050. We did not assume it, and it wasn't included in the plan that we put together for 2018. It only suggests that if it was, we would be able to leverage future earnings from cap and trade and accelerate the construction of the project.
And it's kind of like the idea that it's something like buying a house, right? You use your wages to get your mortgage, and in this situation, you're using this
bonds.
Money. Right, to get bonds, and et cetera. Let me ask you this. So the most recent business plan also says that there's going to be federal funding, or could be federal funding. Mm-hmm. It's possible. Some people kind of question, why do you think the federal government's going to step in and support high-speed rail in California?
That's been a role that the federal government's played for decades. Mm-hmm. It paid for 90% of the interstate highway system. It pays
90%.
For 90%. It paid for 50% or more of regional rail passenger programs like the Bay Area Rapid Transit. So it's not unrealistic to assume the federal government will eventually put more money into this project.
And what's interesting is this is one of the largest infrastructure projects, well, I think it's ever in California, maybe even in the country.
Yes.
So you would expect, historically, you'd expect the federal government to step in.
And we think that the election would indicate to us that we're far more hopeful to have a bipartisan infrastructure package come through the Congress.
You know, the most recent business plan suggests that the money necessary to complete the San Francisco to L.A. line could come from revenue generated from the Silicon Valley Central Valley line. Mm-hmm. Yet there's no money earmarked specifically to complete the Valley to Valley line. So, you know, if it does get built, what net revenues are you projecting?
We're projecting that we can probably generate, based upon proving our ridership and revenue, that it could be capitalized for somewhere in the neighborhood of $7.9 to $13.7 billion.
So some money. You could generate some money.
Substantial amount of money.
Okay. Let me ask you the last question here. We've got about a minute left in the segment, and I just wanted to ask you about this. You know, there are a lot of people that say, or I should say, there are some people that say, that this money could be better spent on other infrastructure needs. Oh, we need, you know, dams for water or housing or healthcare, et cetera. Even for transportation, they just build more highways. What's your response to that?
Well, California's got a lot of challenges, and we're capable of resolving more than one at a time. And that's what we're doing with high-speed rail.
The chewing gum and walking at the same time analogy?
We do that well in California. Transportation is a big part of economic vitality in this state and meeting the environmental goals that we've got. High-speed rail fits that bill perfectly.
Well, I want to thank our guest, Tom Richards with the California High-Speed Rail Authority, as well as Tom Van Heek with the Nonpartisan Legislative Analyst Office and John Kapal with the Harvard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. Thanks all of them for joining us, and thank you for joining us. This is Mark Kepler for the Maddie Report.
The views expressed in the Maddie Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Maddie Institute.
There's no question that high-speed rail is a big-ticket item. But the $200 billion state budget has a lot of big-ticket items. Up next, a closer look at some of the bigger items in the state budget.
You're listening to the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, on KMJ.
Each year, California's Nonpartisan Legislative Analyst publishes the California Spending Plan that summarizes the annual state budget. How is the state of California going to spend its almost $200 billion budget? We'll ask. Mac Taylor, California's Legislative Analyst.
Additional funding for the Maddie Report made possible by a grant from The Wonderful Company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Maddie Institute, it's the Maddie Report with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Just how does the state spend your taxpayer dollars? Our guest would know. He's Mac Taylor, California's Legislative Analyst, and the recognized authority on the state budget. Welcome back to the Maddie Report.
Nice to be with you again, Mark.
So each year, the governor proposes a budget in January. What did Governor Brown propose for fiscal year 18-19 back last January?
Well, the governor's budget does come out in early January. That sort of sets the framework for budget discussions. And we had fairly good revenue growth. But the governor basically was proposing what I like to think of as, and what we budget folks call, a workload budget. That is, he wasn't proposing lots of new programs or expanding existing programs. It was like, whatever we were funding, let's continue to fund. You might have cost increases or, mm-hmm. you know, caseload growth, but we're just going to fund what we fund. And so what the governor did with all this new money, he basically put it in reserves. He wanted to increase the reserves, both the required reserves that we can talk about a little bit more that were required under Proposition 2 of 1914 that the voters approved, but also some discretionary reserves. And then whatever money he did spend, it was primarily on one-time purposes.
He didn't like getting over his skis, does he? He likes to kind of be fiscally prudent.
He really has taken to the theme that we established many, many years ago that, you know what, we have a very volatile revenue structure, and you need to save for that rainy day.
So, you know, each May, people might not know this, but each May, after the April tax receipts come in, the governor revises his January budget with something called the May revision. A lot of people call it the May revise. I think that's grammatically incorrect, but anyway.
May revision is what we call
it. The May revision is the correct way to say it. How did the governor's budget change this last May?
Well, the key development in May, as you say, after we learned about how much personal income tax revenue came in, we had a lot more money. And back in January, we thought we would have more money, and so we tried to sort of prepare the legislature for that. Turns out we had about $7.5 billion more over the whole budget window.
That's a lot of money.
That is a lot of money, even for a budget as large as ours. Now, some costs went up also. We had some Medi-Cal, which is a health program for low-income people. We had some costs go up there. School spending went up. So that additional revenue was offset by some additional costs, but the governor did propose to increase reserves even more. And he also proposed a lot of one-time expenditures, particularly in the capital outlay area.
Right. So one-time, it's not going to be continuing, obviously, year after year after year, just a one-time hit. So then you go forward to June, and the governor and the legislature settle on a final budget. How did that differ from the May revision?
You know, it was kind of a combination of the reserves were a little bit less, more what the governor had proposed in January. There was a little more spending. The legislature obviously negotiates with the governor. There was more money, for example, for universities. There was more money put in for homelessness. But I would say the overall framework was pretty much what the governor laid out. We're going to put a lot of money aside for reserves. And when we do spend money, it's going to be primarily for one-time things.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, when you take a look at a budget, I've always disagree with me if I'm wrong, but it's kind of it's the objective manifestation of policy, right? Isn't that what a budget is?
It's setting your priorities.
Right. I mean, that's in a very tangible way.
And year to year, the whole reason you have an annual budget, the same way that you reevaluate your own personal budget, mm-hmm. is, well, what do we want to do now? What is of higher priority? What is of lower priority?
And it seems pretty clear to the governor, to Governor Brown, at least in his last budget, what higher education was a priority, setting aside money for a reserve.
Well, and
for
the legislature. They actually pushed for money, too.
Yes, of course.
And so that's that give and take between the two branches. But clearly, preparing for the next recession, in effect, was one of the governor's highest priorities.
He keeps talking about that. I mean, and if you look at it, and if you look at historically, we've been in a pretty good economic growth pattern for a while now, and it's like, it seems like we're due. I'm not asking you for a prediction, but it seems like, wow, this has been going on for a while.
You know, we started turning around. I think the recession technically ended in 2009. So we're coming on a decade of growth. It's one of the longest recovery periods in our, you know, modern history.
Yeah, that makes people a little nervous. So the overall spending picture for the state of California, excluding federal funds and bond funds, how would you describe it? I mean, how much has spending increased generally and how much specifically for the general fund and for these special funds?
Yeah, there's the two types that you just mentioned. The general mm-hmm. fund is what you would think as your main operating account. Mm-hmm. Your main checking account is where we put most of our money in, and it can be spent for any reason, any purpose at all.
Right.
But then we have what these that are called, and it's a smaller part of our budget. It's probably 40% of what our general fund budget is, special funds. And you should think of those as money that's paid, but it's usually spent and dedicated towards a particular purpose.
Right.
If you are a contractor or have a license.
Box.
Well,
I don't
know, like a lockbox, but think of it if you were had to have a license for your occupation.
Right.
You would pay a fee, and it would go for that purpose of regulating your profession.
Right. Okay. So and so there's some money there in the special funds as well as the general funds.
The general fund grew relatively rapidly.
Yeah, I think I was reading, was it 9%?
9%, which is a big year-over-year increase. Special funds did not grow that much, about 2%.
Okay. Well, up next, how did the state decide to spend your money? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking about how taxpayer dollars are being spent by the state with Mac Taylor, California's nonpartisan legislative analyst. So we're talking about the state's budget. It's about $200 billion total budget. Of that, the legislature has about $10 billion what's called discretionary general fund money after they fund existing programs. Can you explain that discrepancy?
Sure. And it might be better to compare that $10 billion against the general fund's total budget of about $140 billion.
Okay.
So what does that mean? And it goes back to this notion we were just talking about on a workload budget. Like you say, if you sort of fund what you've been doing, do you have monies left over for other priorities? It could be reducing taxes, increasing spending, building up reserves. And given all the new money that came, particularly in May, we estimated that, you know, the legislature and the governor had about $10 billion in what we call discretionary. That is
money to play with.
Kind of money to play with. But again, that could be for reserves or reducing taxes, whatever you want to do with it. And so that was the amount that we tried to characterize. Well, sort of what happened with that money?
Right. Yeah. It's interesting. You were saying, you know, this discretionary money excludes dollars controlled by constitutional funding requirements like Prop 98. Prop
98 exactly.
is a big cut of the budget.
It's 40% of the budget, and it has its own formulas. And so whatever those formulas would dictate, if it grows by 2 or 3% or whatever, that's part of the workload budget. And then you have money above that you could add to this educational spending or other purposes.
For a layperson, I kind of look at, okay, I pay a mortgage on a house. I know if I'm projecting next year's budget, I know I'm going to be spending this much money on my mortgage. But I haven't got a raise, so where can I spend the additional money?
And it might be that your mortgage was a variable rate. So your existing program wouldn't be what you were paying this year. It's what you're going to have to pay next year under that variable rate.
Right.
But it's still the same program.
Right.
So we would try to look above that and say, okay, well, after you pay for your higher interest rate on your variable, what do you have left over for other priorities of your family?
Okay. So let's talk about that for a second. How did the governor of the legislature allocate that $10 billion?
Again.
Specifically.
The number one reason, almost half of those monies went for additional reserves.
Rainy day. Well, isn't that just the rainy day fund, but just it's putting money aside.
These are additional monies on top of that they wanted to set aside just to make available for the legislature and the governor to be able
They're
to use.
They're putting a lot of money aside.
They are setting aside a lot of money. But remember, you have to think about the state's revenue structure. It is very volatile. It can swing tens of billions of dollars from a good year growth to going below what you're
And explain for audience why is it so volatile.
It's volatile for a variety of reasons, but basically because we rely on the personal income tax, and much of the personal income tax is paid by 1% of taxpayers.
Okay, so it's very progressive. It's capital gains.
And capital gains and other forms of volatile income like business income, stock option, bonuses.
When the stock market is doing well, California
we do really well.
Doing fantastic. Of course, the reverse is also true.
And that's the problem. That's why Governor Brown in particular has kept talking about how fast you can lose money if you turn into a recession.
So let's talk about revenues for a minute. What are the projections for the state for 2018-19? And how much has the general fund taxes actually increased?
You know, they're projected to increase in this current year by about 4% on the big three taxes. And those big three are personal income, sales tax, and corporate tax.
But the general fund, we talked earlier, was increasing at 9%.
The spending was. We actually spent down on some of our discretionary reserves year over year. It's a little counterintuitive because we're building up these other revenues.
Okay.
But so revenue growth was pretty good in 18-19. It was especially good in 17-18. So we're coming off a very big year. But the growth was not, you know, particularly rapid. But we actually felt like the administration was probably underestimating revenues for the year.
Yeah, that's actually a trick that he's used more than once.
Well, I wouldn't call it a trick.
It's
being cautious.
Cautious, right. It's an approach.
But I think as a result of that approach, which is a perfectly justifiable thing if you want to be careful that you don't overcommit, but it has meant that we've tended to raise our estimates of revenues once they finally came.
But one of the caveats with setting aside a reserve is that money's not, quote unquote, being used for services, goods and services. So that's the quid pro quo. It's not like you're...
It's like free money that you just put aside.
Right,
it means it's just not available for other things.
Right. So I want to ask you about the final budget packet assumes in 18-19 we'll end up with a $16 billion reserve. All this money isn't in just one rainy day account. It's actually in several accounts. Can you explain a little bit about the different accounts? How much is in each? What are the limitations?
Sure. I think that's a really important question. Let me focus on two that really have most of our reserves. The first one is based on Proposition 2 of 1914 when we set up this rainy day fund. And it's very important because this is guided by constitutional rules. How much money goes in each year based on how much capital gains we have, what total revenues are, and the constitutional rules guide how you can take money out of it. So the legislature doesn't have a lot of control over that.
Right. Okay.
And that has most of the reserves. Of the $16 billion you mentioned, almost $14 billion is in this so-called rainy day reserve.
I want to say it's that 10% of the general fund?
When people revenues? Passed Proposition 2, it had a 10% sort of, it's not a cap as much as it's a target level, but what happens once you hit 10%, monies are used for a different reason. The other reserve is just what we call the free reserve. It would just be like your checking account balance that's available for you to do whatever you want. And it is guided by statute. Legislature can do whatever it wants with that.
But a lot less.
A lot less right now.
Okay. Well, this year's budget generally focused on one-time spending and building more reserves. The money was spent on a variety of other issues. We're going to talk about those in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with California's legislative analyst, Mac Taylor, about the 2018-19 state spending plan. Education, we talked about it earlier, lion's share of the budget, 40% of the budget. And you said that there's considerable new spending in virtually every education segment, from early childhood through college. So early education, how did it do under the budget?
Early education, which consists of both child care programs and preschool, which has obviously a more educational aspect to it, did extremely well. They had about a 16% increase in their spending year over year. And there was basically two components of that. We provided a lot more slots, that is, places for kids, throughout the state. And we also increased reimbursement rates that we pay to providers, and with the thought that, you know, that will encourage more supply.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, the pre-K stuff has been going on. There's been discussions about this for a long time. The former Senator Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg, I believe, was a proponent of pre-K. You know, they want to have universal pre-K. That's another issue, but that's a pretty big ticket item.
That would cost a lot more money because we're not serving all the people who are eligible.
Right.
But on a year-to-year basis, this was a substantial increase.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that they increased the number of slots, but they also increased the reimbursement rates because if you have the slots, but you don't have anybody willing to do the job, then it's like you don't have the slots.
Exactly.
Right? So you got to do the reimbursement rates. So what about K-12 education?
K-12 education also, which as we said is the biggest single piece of the budget, and they got a rather large year-to-year increase in discretionary money.
They've been doing well for years now.
They've been doing very well because we had to sort of make up
right.
from when we had reduced spending during the Great Recession. And they've been getting a big chunk of revenue increases. So they have been doing very well. And I would say 18-19 was another very good year. They had about $5.8 billion increase effectively over what had been committed in 17-18. Most of this was for ongoing.
Right.
Almost all of the money went into our basic funding formula, that just money that's distributed to schools.
That's the local control funding formula.
Exactly.
Which kind of gives the locals the ability to decide how they're going to spend that money, which I'm sure they really like.
Yes, and we had set targets, the funding that we wanted to reach by some in the out years, and we've reached it early. We have fully funded that local control funding formula targets that we'd set 3 or 4 years ago. So most of the money just went to that. And then there was a big chunk of spending that was for a variety of one-time things, with the biggest piece being, again, these what we call discretionary grants to locals. They could use it for any one-time purpose that they wanted.
There's a lot of focus, and it seems like to me, you can correct me if I'm wrong, the way the budget is going by the legislature and the governor toward low-performing schools and students, people that are a little bit more educationally challenged, to try to raise those numbers, those levels.
The whole local control funding formula is geared towards giving considerably more money for students who are either low income or English learners.
And the argument would be that they probably need more help, more assistance in kind of getting their academic achievement up and closing that academic achievement gap, which is
considerable.
Right.
And that was the theory behind the whole formula.
Well, we got community. What about community colleges? The other things like career technical education, online community colleges. What's happening there?
Community colleges who've also been doing very well, again, as this funding formula, Proposition 98, has required large increases in recent years. And in 18-19, they also got a $1.2 billion
increase.
Because they're
part of, it's interesting, they're part of Prop 90. People forget that community colleges are part of that calculation.
They take about just over a tenth of the total Prop 98, but they are part of that calculation. And the whole Prop 98, which is K-12 and community colleges, is about 40% of our whole budget. If you add in the universities, that's where you get to almost half the budget is for education.
Right. So we're talking about, so I think I may have cut you off, in terms of online community colleges, there's money for that. There's something that Governor Brown has been pushing.
Yes. There's a lot of one-time things again. There's also about 800 of that $1.2 billion was just generally going money out for per-student increases.
Right.
So again, community college district just had a lot more discretion over having more money to spend in whatever way they thought was appropriate to serve their local community.
And then there's higher education, the UC and the CSUs.
Right. And they did fairly well. General fund support for the CSU system increased by 9.5%. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a little bit overstated for a couple of reasons. Some of that money was only on a one-time basis.
Okay.
And there are generally no tuition increases.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's a hook there. You can have the money, but...
Well, and then you have to think, well, tuition supports a pretty big part of their core program.
Right.
And if you're not allowing that funding source to increase, you got to make it up almost on the other part. So that 9.5 after you adjust for those two things isn't anywhere near as great as it might seem.
Yeah, one last thing I want to ask you in this segment, that is about healthcare and mental health. How did they do in the state budget?
There were some interesting developments in that. For example, in healthcare, because of the tax increases on cigarettes that the voters recently approved, there was a large chunk of money, over $820 million, that went to the Medi-Cal program for rate increases for providers of
Again,
healthcare.
With the rate increases, because you want people to actually provide
have
the
access.
Service. Yeah. Okay, well, more with Mac Taylor in a moment about the state spending plan. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. I'm talking with Mac Taylor, California's legislative analyst, about the 2018-19 state spending plan. Homelessness, big issue. Housing, big issue because of the sky-high housing prices and rents and whatnot. No one expects that the state's going to be able to fix the housing issue by state spending alone. However, there is a considerable amount of state spending to address this issue. What's happening with the state budget when it comes to homelessness and housing issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think your point is a good one, that most housing is provided by the private sector, and there's not a problem not huge problems necessarily in providing homes for many types of people. What is more difficult is housing for certain groups, and I think the homeless is one where the legislature has been particularly concerned. So they dedicated on a one-time basis $500 million. which is it's a good chunk of money. Right. And these are grants to local governments.
You know, I wanted to ask you that because I thought about when I was reading that in your report, I'm thinking, is that RDA 2.0? You used to have something called redevelopment agencies that would give money to local governments and they could spend it.
No, this is really just money going to local governments that could spend for a variety of homelessness related projects.
So I was reading too much into that.
Yes, I think so.
Okay, which happens. That's why you're here to correct me. All right, so there's the issue of related issue of poverty. According to the Public Policy Institute of California, 4 out of 10 Californians live near or below poverty levels. And if you took away the state safety net, like things like CalFresh, CalWORKS, earned income tax credits, it would result in about half of all Californians being at or near the poverty level. So how is poverty addressed in the state budget?
You know, I think the legislature has been very concerned about this now for several years, and they took a variety of steps. Two of the bigger ones were they increased cash assistance payments to people for, you know, temporary assistance. Mm-hmm. That's called the CalWORKS program in California. They also they did something for poor and disabled seniors. And it's called a cash-out program, but basically it made them eligible for food benefits, what we used to call food stamps.
Just before they couldn't get it.
They couldn't get it because they had this little $10 cash-out, but they'll be eligible for a lot more benefits. Most people, most of the seniors and disabled, would be eligible for a lot more total benefits with this action that the legislature took.
And there's the earned income tax credit, which is a way to kind of encourage people to work if they're lower income.
Very low income people. We expanded that. We have there's a federal earned income tax credit. The state adopted one several years ago. They expanded it to include more people. So I would say a variety, including the homelessness grants that we just talked about, a lot of different variety of steps to try to address some of these issues.
Helping the elderly, the disabled, et cetera. Let me ask you this. There's also another $1.5 billion in there for various infrastructure projects. What exactly are they putting money up for?
Again, this are these one-time things that the governor liked. If we're going to spend, one-time things were higher on his priority list. Most of it is in capital outlay, infrastructure.
And there was a big project that was part of this. Why wasn't there?
There is one big project. It's on
because I heard it. I heard it in campaign ads. They're spending all this money for a nice place for themselves. And what are they talking about there?
It's called the Capitol Annex. It's the building in back of the old traditional Capitol that houses all of the members and much of their staff. Mm-hmm. The building is fairly dilapidated, and something had to be done. And so they finally took action to dedicate some monies to start the planning process to build a new Capitol Annex. And I think their hope is it'll be a much friendlier building, not only for the people who use it, but for people who visit the Capitol.
I guess it was $630 million for the Capitol Annex. And if you've been to the Capitol, you kind of you do notice going from one building to the other that there is definitely a difference. But that building, I guess, was built in 1952, and they felt, you know, maybe we ought to do a little upgrading.
It's a tough one, obviously, for members to take on, but hopefully we'll have a building in 4 or 5 years that will be much better for the public also.
Right. Okay. So any other major features in the budget package?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's just a whole variety of other actions. For example, during the process, they put on the ballot Proposition 2 of this year, which voters just recently voted on, and that allowed the mental health monies, the so-called millionaire tax proceeds, that is dedicated towards mental health. It allowed the state to issue bonds to build housing for the mentally ill homeless, particularly veterans.
Very rough estimate. But usually when you look at those bonds in the propositions, you should generally basically double it for what it's actually going to cost you over the period of the
payment. Because of interest.
So it's like putting it on your credit card.
Yeah.
In some ways, I guess that's the best way to kind of
think
about that.
Except, fortunately for the state, because the feds exempt that the tax, the income that you earn on bonds, is actually a fairly low rate. So the state borrows at a fairly good rate.
Okay, we only got about 30 seconds left, but I did want to ask you about some of the other interesting nuggets you might have found in the state budget. Anything come to mind that kind of grabbed your attention?
Well, I think there are a lot of little things that, we had money for electric
Valley
stations.
Valley fever research.
Exactly.
EV charging stations.
The charging stations, whatever.
The earthquake early warning system.
We also had some fairly substantial policy proposals. They adopted a new way of allocating money for community colleges that I think will have to be worked out over the coming years. So there were some large policy proposals as well.
You got to drill down. It's funny that, you know, say it's budget dust, $2 or $3 million here or there, but there's a lot of things in that budget, and it does tell you a lot about the priorities. I want to thank Mac Taylor, California's legislative analyst, for being with us. If you want to stay current with state and local politics, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or log on to our website at MattyInstitute.com. This is Mark Kepler for the Matty Institute. Thanks for joining us.
If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Matty Report, visit our website at MattyInstitute.org.
The views and opinions expressed in the Mattey Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Mattey Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Mattey Report, visit our website at MatteyInstitute.org.
The Mattey Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Mattey Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.